Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Welcome to the EAN Cast weekly neurology episode. My name is Maria Pia Giannoccaro, and I'm an assistant professor of neurology at the University of Bologna, Italy, and head of the Neuroimmunology Lab at the IRCCS Istituto delle Scienze Neurologiche of Bologna. This month's topic is neuroimmunology, and in today's episode, we will talk about autoimmune encephalitis. My guests today are Alberto Vogrig and Martin Pitler. Alberto is an assistant professor at the University of Udine, Italy, and currently co-chair of the EAN Scientific Panel of Neuroimmunology. He completed his PhD in neuroscience at the University of Lyon, France, and his research focuses on autoimmune encephalitis, paraneoplastic neurological syndromes, and neurological complications of cancer immunotherapy. And Martin Pitler is Associate Professor of Neurology at the Erasmus University Medical Center of Rotterdam in the Netherlands. He has the ERN accredited nationwide referral center for diagnostic and treatment of autoimmune encephalitis, and he has an active translational research line in autoimmune encephalitis. Welcome, Alberto and Martin, and thank you for joining us today to talk about this fascinating topic. In the last decades, there has been an increase in our awareness and knowledge about the diagnosis and treatment and pathophysiology of autoimmune encephalitis, but there are still some gaps in our understanding of the disease and several challenges in the identification and management of patients affected by these conditions. So let me start, Martin, what key clinical signs or symptoms should raise suspicion for autoimmune encephalitis, and how can we differentiate this condition from other potential diagnoses?
Thank you for the invitation to be here. Autoimmune encephalitis is, in a way, difficult to discriminate because it's a rare disease, but it can manifest as with every symptom, depending on what part of the brain is affected. But generally speaking, most patients will have a subacute onset, meaning that it will be within 6 weeks, 3 months, or sometimes days, more like an infectious encephalitis. And they will have, depending on what part of the brain is affected, for example, if it's the limbic system, then generally it's about memory, behavior, and seizures. If it's about the cerebellum, you will develop ataxia, more ataxia of the legs than the arms, more of the stability than it is about the eye movements. But the main thing is that it can be a little bit less outspoken. So the encephalitis, the pleocytosis can be less explicit or even absent compared to our idea about infectious encephalitis. The MRI can be abnormal, but can be normal as well. So you should have a low burden to expect it, to look at it. But also, if you don't understand your phenotype, and a lot of like the usual less rare suspects have been excluded, you should definitely continue to say like, okay, I really don't understand this. Could this be one of those more rare syndromes, and continue towards investigating, especially as most of them are treatable. You shouldn't, of course, not wait until all the genetics research has come back. You have to take it rather upfront in your differential diagnosis.
And what are the most common antibody-mediated syndromes in terms of, different subtypes? So we know we have different antibodies, surface antibodies or intracellular antibodies.
Yeah, I think from the extracellular target antigens, NMDA receptor encephalitis and LGI1 are the two most common, depending on the area, depending on the country, one or the other might be more prevalent. LGI1 generally in patients over 50, but can occur in younger, while NMDA, the median age is about 21. But as we know now, 15% of patients are 60 and over, so they're getting a little bit towards each other. LGI1 is a typical limbic encephalitis with memory issues, seizures, the pataknomonic facial breakout dystonic seizures, although they only occur in about 45% of the patients. More commonly, they have focal epilepsies that are very stereotypical, and NMDA is generally also a quite homogeneous phenotype that you should be able to recognize. If we look at the others, YO for cerebellar degeneration is the most common, HU for sensory neuronopathy, and GAD65 for stiff person or cerebellar ataxia or epilepsy. I think those are the most common, while all the others are a little bit less frequent. Maybe GFAP, astrocytopathy, and IGLON5 disease are two antibodies that have a huge amount of underdiagnosis, often not recognized. So I'm not completely sure what the real incidence.
Agree. We know that many clinicians rely on antibody testing to diagnose autoimmune encephalitis. Still, we also know that the turnaround time of this kind of testing can take several weeks. So in the meantime, we can perform some paraclinical studies such as CSF analysis, MRI, and EEG. So, Alberto, what do these paraclinical studies typically show in patients with autoimmune encephalitis, and how can these findings help confirm a diagnosis versus other conditions?
Thank you very much, Maria Pia, for this important question, and thanks the EAN for having me. So, after autoimmune encephalitis is suspected clinically, as Martin clearly explained, we need a detailed workup to both confirm the diagnosis, but also to exclude alternative diagnoses such as infectious encephalitis or systemic metabolic causes. Usually the workup includes brain imaging and CSF analysis. Brain MRI should be performed with contrast and can show changes consistent with one or more of the key anatomical syndromes that were already discussed. So one of the most frequent is limbic encephalitis, which typically involve the mesial temporal lobes, and we can see this involvement in the MRI with hypersignal in the FLAIR sequences involving these structures. It is important to highlight that involvement of extralimbic structures or the presence of contrast enhancement or diffusion restriction are observed more frequently in autoimmune encephalitis mimics rather than autoimmune encephalitis cases. As you said, EEG is very useful and also non-invasive, and can be useful in the differential diagnosis of primary psychiatric disorders, in which the EEG is typically normal, versus autoimmune encephalitis cases in which it is typically abnormal, with prominent slowing, either focal or generalized, or subclinical seizures. For example, in some specific form of autoimmune encephalitis, such as NMDA receptor encephalitis, we can observe also some specific patterns such as extreme delta brush. Conversely, in anti-LJ1 autoimmune encephalitis, we can see a lack of interictal epileptiform discharges, but frequent subclinical temporal seizures, sometimes induced by hyperventilation. And finally, as you said, cerebrospinal fluid examination is really important. In autoimmune encephalitis, we can see typically mild to moderate lymphocytic pleocytosis. Typically, this is less pronounced than in infectious encephalitis. We can also see positive intrathecal oligoclonal bands. But it's true that the CSF findings can be different according to the type of antibody-mediated syndromes. For example, in anti-LJ1 or EGLON5 antibody-mediated encephalitis, we can have also normal standard CSF examination. While in NMDA receptor encephalitis, there is usually a pronounced pleocytosis. And finally, in GFAP encephalitis and encephalomyelitis, we can see some findings similar to infectious encephalitis with marked pleocytosis and reduced glucose in the CSF.
Yeah, and maybe to add the this link between pleocytosis seems to be also related to the timing from onset. So the NMDA is generally more subacute onset, while the LGR1 and IGLON5, it takes more time. And also in NMDA, it has been shown, for example, by the Oxford group, that the pleocytosis will fade away in most NMDA cases, independent of treatment over time. And one other important thing for EEG is that the LGR1, especially the short seizures, are typically not captured on EEG, but that doesn't mean that it's not seizures. If you do a lot of like scientific back averaging and those kind of more difficult EEG analysis, you can identify issues that has been shown by the French courts. But it's too often, unfortunately, I see that we don't see it on EEG, so it shouldn't be seizures. That's definitely the wrong way of deducting.
Thank you both for your answers. And so the absence of some paraclinical seizures does not necessarily rule out diagnosis of autoimmune encephalitis. So we have to keep it in mind. And also on the other end, we should be also aware of the fact that there are several meanings of the disease. So really considering the whole clinical phenotype is very important in order to not to overdiagnose. On the other hand, autoimmune encephalitis. What about tumor screening, Alberto, in these patients? Because we know there are some paraneoplastic syndromes. So how long for should we search for a tumor and in which conditions?
So this is a very important point. At the beginning, we need to do a comprehensive tumor screening in all patients because we don't know at the beginning if this autoimmune encephalitis syndrome in this specific patient is paraneoplastic or not. Of course, there are some demographic and risk factor that can direct us in one or the other, but one complete screening with a complete CT scan of the thorax, abdomen, and pelvis, followed, if negative, by a PET scan is probably recommended in all patients. Then, when we get the antibody results, we can stratify the patient according to the type of the antibody in three different levels of risk of having an underlying cancer. Let's say some patients with high-risk antibodies, such as HU, are very likely to have an underlying cancer, especially small cell lung cancer. And so we should aggressively screen for this type of cancer later if no cancer is found at the first screening. This can be done every 4 to 6 months for at least 2 years, but probably even longer for some specific cases. And at the opposite side of the spectrum, there are low-risk patients such as LJ1 cases in which one complete screening is probably sufficient.
Thank you very much. Martin, do you want to add something on this point?
No, completely agreed. And only important is that if you're looking at NMDA or young male patients with trials like 11 or MAT2 antibodies, that those are often not detected by PET scan. So because it's not a malignant tumor, often more benign. So there you should focus on ultrasound or MRI of important regions.
Thank you. Antibody testing is a crucial part of a diagnosis, right? So, Martin, what are the key considerations and potential pitfalls when it comes to antibody screening in patients with AE? Are there any specific challenges or nuances clinicians should be aware of?
Yeah. We have the luxury of having a laboratory where we can validate all the results from the commercial test by a tissue analysis. Generally, most physicians do not have this luxury. So they send away a sample, preferably serum and CSF, because for different antibodies, you might need a different specimen. So for example, NMDA, is better examined in CSF, GFAP as well. LGR1, the commercial assay, is less sensitive in CSF, so you definitely need serum. So send in both. You don't have to test all antibodies in both serum and CSF. That's also, in a way, a waste of money. So then you can get troubles being able to remain testing in your future patients. But important is that you should be always consider the results, as we do with our MRI scan, with our clinical phenotype. We always look like, is this feasible with what we expect? So if you have a patient that has is a young female with psychiatric symptoms, seizures, mutism, movement disorders, and then once goes to the ICU and you have a positive NMDA, the phenotype fits, so then it's fine. If you have a cerebellar degeneration, you get a positive YO, then it's fine. If you get a patient with Parkinsonism and for some reason you ask for antibodies, you get a positive YO, then it's almost certainly not real. So you have to keep considering tests from outside have similar problems with sensitivity and specificity, like MRI, like EEG, like your clinical phenotype. So be as critical as you are towards your own clinical ID. So if it doesn't fit, discuss whether it could be confirmed if it's done by multiple testing, if the antibodies are fit, or the other way around. If you have a patient that really you think it should be autoimmune and your antibodies are negative, then discuss whether the things that you thought are done are actually tested for, or that they for some reason only did part of the panel and therefore did not test the right antibody. So it's all about you are the one in charge, and you have to have the overview. Did I test for the right things? Do I believe the test? And if it fits, it's fine. If not, reconsider. Did I miss something? Are I too trustworthy towards the results? And then generally, this perception should be well enough.
Thank you. This is a very important point you raised there. Sending always serum and CSS. So consider what are you testing for, what is your initial hypothesis, and go back all the time to your clinical phenotype, because this avoids risk of missing some relevant antibodies because it was not maybe included in your original panel the patient was tested for, and also avoid the risk to overinterpret an antibody results that might be not relevant in that clinical phenotype. So moving to treatment, Alberto, what is the current standard treatment approach for autoimmune encephalitis, and how does it vary depending on the type of autoimmune encephalitis? So paraneoplastic or no paraneoplastic?
Thank you. So the treatment of autoimmune encephalitis should consist of, we can say, a combination of three steps. One is the treatment of cancer, if a tumor can be detected, immunotherapy, and symptomatic treatment, of course, depending on the clinical aspect of the patients. So regarding first-line immunotherapy, we should administer this type of treatment even before a cancer is found, because it's really important to treat the patient early with first-line immunotherapy if an autoimmune encephalitis is the diagnostic suspicion. And first-line immunotherapy include intravenous methylprednisolone pulse treatment, but also we can use intravenous immunoglobulins or plasma exchange. There is no preferred first line. We can choose one or the other according to the specificities of the patient and its presentation. It's important to highlight that if there is no satisfactory improvement after 2 to 3 weeks after the first immunotherapy is completed, we should consider a second-line immunotherapy. This consists of either rituximab or cyclophosphamide. These are the two most common approaches. And it's true that there are some specificities according to the type of the antibody. For example, anti-LGA1 patients are particularly responsive to steroids. And so we can consider an oral steroid tapering in some of these patients. And the same applies also to some cases of autoimmune encephalitis triggered by checkpoint inhibitors treatment. Then regarding symptomatic treatment, there are also some advices that are important. For example, in the early phase of anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis, we should be cautious in the use of antipsychotics due to the risk of neuroleptic intolerance in this phase, in this specific type of encephalitis. And regarding seizures, there are some evidence coming from the group of anti-LGA1 patients that sodium channel blockers are probably the most effective type of anti-seizure medication. And of course, we should use this type of medication only in the patient that are experiencing seizures. And finally, I would like just to add that Martin is coordinating a European group in the European Academy of Neurology that is developing a set of guidelines for the treatment of autoimmune encephalitis that will be hopefully be available in this year.
We hope so. Thank you, Alberto. But Martin, what about the chronic management of these patients? How long should these patients be on immunotherapy? And do we need other treatments once the patient is discharged from the hospital after the acute phase?
That really depends on the antibody and the patient. But I think generally our IDs are, we are easier to over-treat most of our patients than under-treat. So I think that different from schizophrenia or different from epilepsy syndromes, most patients in the long term do not develop a neurodegenerative disorder or a symptomatic chronic epilepsy. And therefore, we should consider that in most of the cases, you will not need long-term antipsychotic medication or anti-seizure medication, and it's definitely worth to taper down to monotherapy, or what we always try is to get rid of therapy in the end, because it can harm your way, it can have cognitive side effects, and therefore can harm your rehabilitation process. Of course, you have to do this in a slow, safe setting. You're not in a hurry unless it's really harming your rehabilitation. And then if patients do develop more symptoms, you might need a little bit more time. But most of our patients were able to taper down to no anti-seizure medication, no antipsychotics. Related to immunotherapy, it's a little bit more difficult issue because it really depends on the antibody. So for example, in NMDA, most of the patients do not need chronic immunotherapy. In the intracellular targets, most of the patients will not need chronic immunotherapy. LGR1 has a higher relapse risk. About 1/3 of patients will have relapses. So in those patients, you might need to consider azathioprine and mycophenolate. Newest data show that maybe rituximab in acute phase reduces the relapse frequency, and therefore you might not need to add those, but we have to see how long that effect will last. And for Caspar-2, it seems that relapse rate is also quite high and that you might need continued immunotherapy, but this is just very new data that will need validation from other cohorts. But I think generally most of the diseases are more a disease like Guillain-Barré syndrome than it's like myasthenia gravis or neuromyelitis optica, where you have to treat them lifelong. But there's no absolutes here.
Thank you. And another hot topic, I think, is antibody-negative autoimmune encephalitis. When should we diagnose antibody-negative autoimmune encephalitis, and how should we treat these patients?
This is a challenging question, so I will just say a few words and then I will let Martin say his opinion. So basically, what we can say is that there was an increased awareness of autoimmune encephalitis in the last decade, and of course this was a positive thing, but this has led to two unintended consequences. So the first is that a high frequency of misdiagnosis was made, and the second is that there was an inappropriate use of diagnostic criteria for antibody negative disease. And this probably relate also to the fact that not all the laboratories use tissue-based techniques. So in fact, many antibody negative cases are not really negative. This is one problem. And the other is that sometimes physicians use the concept of autoimmune encephalitis when they don't know what the diagnosis is. And of course, this is not correct. And we should really be strict on the subacute aspect of the presentation. I think this is crucial.
Martin, do you want to add something on this topic?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with Alberto that if the phenotype fits and your antibody fits, then you don't need sometimes all the additional criteria. But if you do not have a proper cause and you have a diagnosis in a way that is a syndrome, a set of symptoms, a set of ancillary testing, but no definite answer, then you need to be critical and use the term seronegative only if it fits the criteria, the strict criteria. If not, you're still fine to consider, like, okay, could this be something neuroinflammatory? Do I need to do my homework again? Do I need to do a diagnostic workup again? And even if you're then stuck, you can even consider to treat these patients. That's fine. But still, you have to be much more careful about, am I still in the right track? Am I not missing something? When should I consider what is like real objective improvement of my immunotherapy, because there's a lot of reasons why people can become a little bit better for a short while after steroid treatments if you admit them for it. So you should be very careful. At the same time, there is the item of seronegative autoimmune encephalitis is probably something real with different diagnoses, with a lot of different systems that are to be investigated and examined in the upcoming 10 years. So we shouldn't throw it away, but we should be very careful in the use to avoid problems with all kinds of patients that are referred to us or treated have side effects for the wrong reasons.
We usually, it's very common to use also a course of steroid or IVIG in these patients, and then you rely on this response to make a diagnosis. But we know that several conditions can respond for several reasons to a course of steroids. So we also always have to be skeptical and go back to the clinical future. So this will be my last question. I look to the future because in these conditions would be great to have a biomarker disease, right? Something that tells you, okay, this is autoimmune encephalitis without relying so much on the antibody or the other things. So do you see in the future anything like that coming, what these biomarkers could be? Biomarker for diagnosis and prognosis that can override in some way the necessity of going through all the antibody panel would be possible, like genetic biomarkers or whatever you can imagine.
I have serious doubts because it's a rare disease, and the problem is that there the different antibodies in a way have effects on the whole brain, parts of the whole brain. So anything that's going on there will in a way resemble what's going on if you have degeneration or other types of inflammation of that same part of the brain. So as long as it's not antibody specific, it will always be generic in a rare disease, comparing it to atypical versions of much more prevalent diseases. For example, rapid Alzheimer will show abnormalities. MS is much more prevalent. So even an atypical form of MS will show immunological features that might resemble generic markers. So I have my doubts whether this will be useful. I do think that there are biomarkers related to antibodies that are useful, but a one size fits all, I think that's a little bit too optimistic.
Thank you, guys. I think we ran out of time. Thank you for joining us today and for having this very interesting conversation about this very exciting field on neuroimmunology. And this kind of conversation, I think, has us to stay up to date in the field. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a nice day.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.